Goodness. I thought I should talk a little bit about the listening that you're doing this week first, and then we'll go on to other things. You're listening to two pieces that involve a lot of technology this week. One is a piece by Morton Subotny called Ascent into Air, and the other one is by Todd Machover called Towards the Center. The thing that both of these pieces have in common, which I personally find very interesting, is that they use a great deal of technology, but the technology is what we call interactive technology. In other words, the performer himself or herself controls what's going to happen in the piece because the computer and the rest of the technology is somehow or other wired to the performer. Ascent into Air is one of the earlier pieces dealing with this kind of technology. It dates from about 82 or 83. And it's amazing how quickly technology has developed in the last 5 or 6 years. Ascent into Air is a piece that uses the first sort of hybrid between a computer, digital technology, and analog technology. And for those of you who know about synthesizers, it uses what's called a Buchla 400, which was, as I say, this first sort of interface between digital and analog. The piece is, like most of Subotnick's music of that period, related to the metaphor of a butterfly. It's in three sections. The first section sort of representing the caterpillar, the second section the cocoon, and the third section the butterfly. And it's not so much literal as this notion that you have some sort of form, and then it goes through this subtle transformation which you don't know quite what's happening, and then it emerges as something completely different, or seemingly completely different. The piece itself is, as I say, highly controlled by the players in many ways. It deals, all the instruments are in pairs. There's two trombones, two cellos, two clarinets, two pianos, two percussion. And the two cellos actually are the controllers of the piece. And because it's sort of primitive in its technology, actually one cello is the on switch and the other one's the off switch. And so when one plays, it activates the computer. When the other one plays, it stops that particular program and advances it to the next one. And it has many ways of interacting. One of the ways, for example, it'll interact is, let's say the trombones are amplified with a microphone. Well, let's say the speed of the bow of the cello, how fast the bow goes, will control how the sound moves around the room. There are speakers all around the room in a live performance, so if the cello goes real fast, the sound will spin real fast. If the cello goes slowly, the sound will barely move around the room. There's other sections of the piece, for example, where the percussion are amplified, and every time the piano plays, it opens up the amplification. So the percussion all of a sudden pops out, and then the second the piano stops playing, the percussion comes back into the piece. This was also a stage performance. Of course, you can't hear that on the record. That was done for the Olympic Arts Festival. And it was done by Lee Brewer, those of you who know him. He's quite a famous director in New York. And we did it on a stage where all the performers were facing the audience, and it was what they call a rake stage, which was at about a 15% angle going up, and I was actually at the back of the stage, and all the performers were facing the audience, and all the performers saw me on video. It was the only way they could, obviously, if I'm standing behind them, see me. And it was quite amazing, because it looked as though we were all sort of charging at them, because, you know, you're on this 15% angle emerging into the audience. Which also presents an interesting problem from a performance point of view, because video reverses everything. So if I wanted to cue someone over here, I had to point this way, which was also sort of startling to the audience, because I go like this, and then the player over there would come in. It was also a very strange performance, because I've never conducted on an angle before, where you're almost falling over. The other piece is by Todd Machover, and Todd is coming on Friday. I know Friday is problematic for some people, but if you could possibly come, Todd is quite wonderful. He's the director of the music part of the Media Center at MIT. And MIT probably in the United States now has the most advanced technology of any place in the country. And Todd is in his sort of mid-30s and has always been very, very influential in the development of technology around the world. And he's an incredibly interesting fellow. So I invited him to come and talk about technology. Anyway, today's class is going to be a little different than we've done before. I'm calling this the Week of the Living Composer. You met Earl Kim on Monday, and you're going to meet taught on Friday, so I thought today I wouldn't come back as a teacher. I thought I'd come back as a composer instead. And we'll do the class in the following way. I thought I would answer any questions you have, especially ones about composition, because I know a lot of the sections have brought up particular problems about how do you write for flute if you don't play the flute, things like that. And I thought I'd play a short piece of mine, about a 10-minute piece, and that would allow us to talk about that, too. The class is going to be short because we have to do the cue guide today, so we don't have a great deal of time. Also, I'm probably very incoherent today because I just got back from California, so it's 7 in the morning for me, and I usually don't talk at 7 in the morning. So if I wax completely incoherent, don't worry about that. So before I play the piece, are there any general questions you'd like to ask at this stage that have been bothering you all term that I could answer for you? This is the one class I purposely didn't plan so that you could control it. Otherwise, I'll play the piece. So I'll play the piece if there are no questions. this is the last piece I finished. It's about a year and a half old. I've been working on another piece since, which I haven't finished. It was a piece I wrote when I first came to Harvard, actually. And I spent about 9 or 10 months on it. It's a piece called Movable Dough. The title has many levels to it. In technical music, we talk about, you all know do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, do. Well, there's always this sort of controversy about whether when you speak about do, which is the main pitch, whether it should always be the same note, or whether you can move it and just transpose everything to that particular pitch. So that's what Movable Do is called. It was a piece that I wrote right after I got married to the flute player you saw the other day. And her name is Dorothy, and her nickname is Do. And I wanted to write a piece as sort of for her on the occasion of getting married. We had been together 8 years, so it wasn't a new thing. But at that stage of our lives, we were both in a lot of different places at the same time. I was in California, I was here, we were in Aspen, she was in all, so I decided to call it Movable Dough, since we were always moving around. And what I did is I don't want to be too technical about it, because I don't want to influence how you hear the piece, but in a kind of cryptic way, I translated letters of the alphabet into notes, and I took her name, and her name is the basis of the whole piece. And the harmonic structure and the melodic structure and everything you hear are all taken from her name. And it's one piece of all the pieces I've ever written that I decided not to really plan anything about. Usually I've gone in every direction from planning pieces extremely carefully, spending 6 or 7 months, you know, making charts and graphs and all sorts of elaborate plans to sort of questioning how much I should plan. And so this piece, I decided to really question the planning of the piece and to not make any decisions ahead of time. And what I did was I only wrote this opening of the piece, which is, as I say, based on her name. There's three little melodies you're here at the beginning. One is her first name, then her middle name, then her last name. And I decided, rather than planning, since I was moving all the time at that stage, to just keep re-looking at the material and going back to it and seeing how I thought about it the next day. And then looking at it again 6 months later, wherever I was, and coming back to it the same way. So it's a very unstructured piece in that way. And it's about 10 minutes long. I'll play it for you. Thank you. piece, by the way, is for seven instruments. It was flute and oboe and trombone, violoncello, piano, and one percussion. So that's what you were hearing. Any questions at this stage? No? No questions at all? Please. In a certain way, the process isn't the purpose, as in any piece, in a certain way. Composers always fool themselves into doing all sorts of processes to make the piece come out, but that's not the purpose. The idea of embedding words in music has gone back to medieval times of taking, or numerology, both. You find it even in, you know, Renaissance music. The process was a very simple one of simply taking the alphabet and cycling it around so that different letters match different pitches. And then the da-da-da-da-da-da-dum was Dorothy. Da-dee-da was her middle name, and da-dee-da-da-da was Stone. And that was the full name. And that's all I started with the piece. And this piece, one thing composers go back and forth with a lot over and over is how much there is process and how much is planned and how much you sort of trust your intuition. And when I began writing music in, what, about 1965, 66, I think most of us in those days were highly systematic, probably because the period was in such turmoil that the only way you could really figure out what to do was by starting from scratch and building a piece from the bottom up. And especially in those days, generally the planning of a piece was, in almost all cases, very extreme. But it was also at that same period I met Morton Feldman. He just happened to give a lecture that I heard, and I called him up in New York once when I was there, and I just told him how wonderful I thought the lecture was, and he invited me over, and we spent about 8 hours together that night. And Feldman was a composer that really did not believe in process, in planning at all. He was one that really believed in letting the next note be a result of the previous note and not planning that ahead of time. And when he would write music, he would turn over the page and never look at it again. And he would never go back in a piece and look at a piece one way or another. So I'd always had this dialogue in my mind about how much I should plan and how much I shouldn't plan, and I've played with that in different ways in different pieces. This was the first piece that I decided completely to, in a sense, write it in a Feldman-esque way that had no a priori considerations about what it would do. The one a priori consideration that's been true of all of my music is that I've never believed a piece should go anywhere or tell you anything. It's ironic. Let me regress a second. I think of any community in the world, you people know my musical influences better than anyone, because we spent this whole term talking about, in essence, my musical influences. And when I was beginning to write, there were two major figures that were around me all the time. One was Milton Babbitt, and the other one was John Cage. And it wasn't that I preferred one to the other. It was sort of like you have, you know, relatives, and they're quite different, but you like your relatives, and so one aunt is very different from the other aunt. But one thing that I very much picked up from that period was that I never really believed that music should go anywhere. I really believed that music should be about being where you are at the moment, enjoying being in that moment, and not worrying about going from one place to another place in a kind of coherent or storytelling kind of way. So I think one a priori consideration in anything I've ever done is that it's that music, in my mind, is about a kind of stasis, a kind of being where you are and not worrying about where you're going, where you're coming from. Or another metaphor I've used in the past is you're in a huge lake and you're swimming, and all of a sudden you come up and look around you, and it's quite clear where you are is the proper place to be, but you really don't know how you got there, where you're going, because you're just in the middle of a huge pool. So the only real considerations in the piece ahead of time was this kind of one little tune that I had. Second of all, purposely not planning. And thirdly, never wanting it to add up to a kind of narrative structure. And that was the whole basis of, I guess, where I started from. Yeah, other questions? The question is, if you set up a process, was I ever tempted to cheat at the process? No, I wasn't. Early on, another composer I like very much is Lou Harrison. And, I remember it was one of the first years I was composing, and he was giving a lecture, and someone asked him the same question. And he said, why cheat at solitaire? In other words, when I set up a process, if I didn't follow it through, I would really not know what the process meant and the true conclusion of where it was going to go. So to compromise a process after it was set up was something I never did. After a point, because I started feeling confined in processes that were confining me, what I would start doing is having pieces in multiple sections. And one section, let's say, would be completely controlled by process, and then the next section would be simply kind of a musical parenthesis, thinking about the process, not any restrictions at all. The result of what I've done and what I'm thinking about doing, but without any restrictions in that particular section. But once a process was set up, it was very important to me to follow it through completely. I only wrote one serial piece. It was when I was in college. I studied with Donald Martino, and I thought probably the best way of studying with him, since he was a composer who wrote in a serial style, was to write a piece in a serial style so that we'd have a lot to talk about. It turned out that was probably a wrong conclusion one way or another, because he didn't really care about looking at music that way. I mean, he would usually just look at one bar and spend about an hour and a half talking about how else I could have written that one bar. And it wasn't until about 6 months when I studied with him, he looked at like about 10 bars and he said, how did you get the pitches? But that piece, which was serial, was a very extremely serial piece, because what interested me was having so many layers of serial processes going on that in a sense it negated everything and became static again. I think there were something like 35 layers of controls, how many pitches at a time. And in that piece, actually, another thing I did in the second movement, I remember, was I serialized the emotions I would feel when I wrote that section. And I would sit at the desk sometimes for like 4 hours and even sometimes give up. And I had 12 different emotions that I would feel to write 5 bars or 10 bars, and I would just, until I got into that feeling, I wouldn't write those bars. But it was interesting to me to see what actually serializing the compositional process of how you felt at the time would influence the piece itself. But again, I wouldn't cheat at it. I wouldn't write it unless I was really at that emotion. And I think most composers who deal with extensive processes, unless you really follow them through, you don't really understand enough about them. Another thing you have to understand with composition, I've been at this now for about 25 years, writing music, is that it's a little bit like a child learning vocabulary. When you first write a piece, you're not nearly as sure of what you're going to get. But once you've gone through, let's say, a very technical process of how to get something, and you've gotten that in a piece, you don't need to do that process again. You know how to get that without going to that much trouble. It's, you know, when you first start learning a new word as a kid, you use it very carefully and you try it out. And then as you learn the word more and more and more, you don't even have to think about how you use the word and you can simply use it. And the same thing is true with the musical language. When you get to be, about 20 years into composition, or whatever it is, you start realizing that you have this large vocabulary that you can use without having to go about thinking about how to use it anymore. Yes? After about a year, he asked if I could listen to the piece without hearing the letters. When you write a piece, it takes you quite a while to understand the piece without thinking about how you wrote it. It's inevitable. Another thing to think about is there's been psychological tests, mental tests, and composers tend to listen, or musicians in general, tend to listen to music with their left brain. Non-musicians tend to listen with their right brain. The left brain is the more analytical, the one, you know, the writing, the verbal, the one that uses arithmetic. The right brain is the more intuitive, the sort of the yin side of the mind, the one that can absorb large gestures. Well, I started music when I was 4 years old, and at that age I was, you know, taught always to analyze, to sing, to think about it. So in a certain way, I don't think I can hear music like a person who's not a non-musician. And I don't think I can ever hear that piece the way you do, even if I hadn't written it. And I don't think I can really hear almost any piece the way you do because of the fact that since I was a tiny, tiny kid, I was taught to think about music in an analytical way and thinking about it very actively rather than a passive way. And so consequently, it's hard for me to ever hear a piece of mine without, in a certain way, hearing it in a kind of technical sense and to just listen to it in a pure way. Sometimes really late at night, you know, at 2 in the morning, you can sort of have the experience of just hearing the piece the way it is. And it's interesting listening now to pieces that are, you know, 15, 20 years old and that I really have forgotten, that I hadn't, you know, heard in years and years, that I'm quite distanced from. And then I do forget what I did in the piece and I hear it much more openly. But this piece is still too new for me. The other problem I have with this piece is I've conducted almost all the performances of the piece, so I really know it too well in a certain kind of way. You know, I know what's going to happen almost every moment because I have conducted it so much. Well, not so much, like 4 or 5 times. Yeah. There are a lot of non-traditional effects in the piece. In most of my music, there are a lot of non-traditional effects. And I don't mean it effects because I don't like pieces that are just about sort of a compendium of interesting new sounds. But one thing that's always interested me is the sort of crack of sound where you're not quite sure what you're hearing, where you think it might be something, but it's colored a slightly different way, like looking at clouds and you sort of see a shape in it, and then the shape transfers in a way. And in all my music, from the very beginning, I think this is also a Don Martino influence, I've never written music abstractly. I never, like, write the pitches and then orchestrate it for the oboe. Whenever I think of a musical gesture, I think of it for the instrument it's being written for and the sound that that instrument can make at the time. A lot of composers will write abstractly. In other words, write sort of like a piano score, and then they'll orchestrate it for the instruments. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing to do. It's just against my particular nature. I've always felt that the most organic kind of music was a musical gesture that from the very beginning was thought of for that particular instrument at that time. And in these kinds of effects or new kinds of sounds that you're talking about, a lot of that has to do with, in a sense, of kind of transformation of between somewhere between pitch and noise, something that's not quite clear but is that hints at things. And that's where those gestures come from. Yes? How do you decide what kind of instruments are going to be in the piece was the question. Sometimes it's a given, sometimes it's a commission. In this particular piece, it was a commission, but it was an open commission, and I could write for anything I wanted as long as it's a fairly small ensemble. And because previous pieces had been pretty much for a fairly set ensemble, which is usually like violin, cello, flute, clarinet, piano, percussion, I hadn't really written lately for things like oboe and trombone, and I thought it would be fun. And I had this kind of exotic sound in my ear. I'm not quite sure where. And it's a question I can't really quite answer in a way. This piece settled for a long time, and I kept thinking about the kind of sonorities I wanted in the piece, and the oboe was one of the only ways I could get a particular sonority. Trombone was another way I could get a sonority. I like percussion a lot because it's so open. You can get so many different things, from pitch to non-pitch to hints of pitch to a whole compendium of sound. So I almost always use percussion. Also, I started at a very young age playing percussion, and I know it very, very well. Also, I like piano a lot because it has a huge register. You can go from very high to very low, and you can also get big harmonies out of it, where if you're writing only for single instruments, you always have to combine them to get a lot of notes at the same time. So the sort of piano and percussion were given, and the rest emerged just from the quality of sound I wanted in the piece. And again, that's hard to explain. It's more like, it's kind of like the colors you're going to use in a painting, and as I say, it evolved gradually as thinking about the piece over a period of time. Yeah. Everything I've asked performers to do, I know is possible ahead of time. Sometimes through my own playing of it, sometimes through other composers. It's again like vocabulary. A lot of these techniques have been developed, especially since the 50s. Like all the new techniques for flute were really established in about 1955, 56, and then have been highly refined. And so maybe I'm not sure something will work or not, but I know it's basically in the ballpark, and then I'll go to a performer and I'll give them that before I actually notate it in a piece and say, is this playable and what does it sound like and how stable is it? And it's one of the advantages I have because I perform a lot is I'm around performers a lot, so I have this easy access. And so I've never written abstractly a gesture that I wasn't sure would work and put it in a piece without first checking with performers. It's an important thing. We should probably go on to the cue guide. Let me just also say that in a certain way, I think because of my liberal arts education, I've always felt it's very important not to call myself a composer, but a musician. And that's why I felt it's always been important to teach and perform. I think it gets very local if you just sit at a desk all the time and never deal with performers and never deal with the reality of your materials. I think it's also a little bit of an excuse to not take things seriously if you don't teach in a certain way, too, because teaching keeps you very honest. And I do want to say that this is the last time this course will be taught because I'm leaving Harvard after this year, and I've never enjoyed teaching a course more than this. It's sort of the summation of 22 years of teaching. This is my 22nd year, and of performing. And it's been extremely refreshing for me to sort of put it all together in this form. And I will very much miss this, but the one thing that I can say is that I don't think I've ever enjoyed a student body more than this group and the group I had last year. The level of intelligence, the level of concern, the level of morality has just been quite wonderful for me. And it's a kind of sad thing to say this, but I do want you to realize that it is kind of a precious thing, like hearing a new piece. Things come and things go. And I do want to thank you all for your concern. I'll turn next week. We will finish the course, and I won't get sentimental again, I promise. Tony.